Hey, thanks again for calling, Alpin.
Absolutely.
Thank you for taking some time out. I can imagine that Dubuque is on the edge of their seats waiting for you to come back because you bring such a high level of energetic good fun to your performances.
Well, that's pretty much the kind of show that I'm bringing back to. What's really wonderful is that Dubuque is bringing perhaps, I think, the most meaningful and entertaining and certainly the program that I've worked on most in my career. So I'm proudest of this show than anything else I've really made.
Well, this Chasing Chopin, it's described as sort of an autobiographical mashup, and I loved the terminology, first of all. Secondly, it really does sort of speak to a lot of things. It would be tempting, I think, to go and sort of imagine your life through maybe the eyes of a composer whose music had really resonated with you. But you sort of take the opposite tack. You sort of find ways to show how Chopin's music resonated with you along the way from some early life experiences and find a way to make a very entertaining show out of that.
Yeah, in fact, this show attempts to go a little bit further, that the fact that the Chopin's music is not only able to describe the emotions and experiences of my life, but that this composer is so great because he's able to describe so much of what we all go through, even today, even though this composer, you know, had lived, you know, over 200 years ago. And a lot of people think not only Chopin's music, but all classical music seems kind of removed from the Super Bowl video game Netflix world of today. I think the reason why it resonates even now is that those emotions, the love and loss and triumph over adversity, of course, are emotions that we can all connect to. And that's really what the story is about. Yes, it is my story, the story of the child of Korean immigrants, you know, in 1967, and when I was born in 1976. So it makes it an American story, but it is a story of that I think anyone who is figuring who they are and who has struggled and faced loss and those experiences molded us into what we are today. I think that's what this story can really speak to. And of course, it's illustrated by, you know, some of the most beautiful music ever written.
Absolutely. And there's a couple of so super interesting themes that you touched on there that really resonated with me when I was kind of reading about you and watching some of your performances. Notably, your first career aspiration, I loved this. You said it was a ninja. Love that.
Yeah.
That is the coolest probably thing ever.
Well, I'd say 60 to 70% of kids these days, boys and girls, have the aspiration to be that at some point in their life.
Oh, totally. But what was really interesting to me was then you went on into music. You started at a very early age. I believe, was it violin and piano by the time you were four?
At age of four.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also, you kind of left music for a while after kind of along the way and found yourself studying medicine. And it occurred to me, I'm going, okay, so here's Alpin who's picking three careers where there is a huge demand for perfectionism in performance,
yeah,
and very little room for the errors that all of us human beings are going to make. So
that's so funny that you would say that. Yeah, and along the line, I guess, ninjutsu, I guess, medicine and music, each requiring, obviously, a great deal of training and study. But what's really funny about that is what informed each of those decisions. And I think that all of us can relate to these things as I keep reiterating over and over again. A lot of those are shaped by the people about us, our teachers, our parents, our friends. And each of those categories of people show up in a small vignette during the show. One of the more entertaining characters in my life was my college roommate. I was a semi-professional skateboarder and rollerblader in college. That's how I was making my $300 of rent a month. And, you know, being on the campus of UCLA with this character, whom you will see in the show, who eventually flees the police with me, which actually did happen. You know, this is not the normal backstory of most graduates. But the very fact that this is real is so funny. I performed this at Lincoln Center recently for a student audience. And there was a fifth grade young man from an inner city school. He raised his hand after the show was done during the Q&A. And he said, "Is this real?" And, in fact, it is. And you know that old saying that either art imitates life or life imitates art. It truly is so in this case.
Well, you mentioned that you skateboarded, and I did see that. So you've kind of been rooted in an extensive classical training background, but you also boast some skills in martial arts and video games, which I love too, and extreme sports. So I'm saying to myself, okay, I get where the martial arts, that would totally assist with discipline and practice that is so mm-hmm. necessary to really cultivate a good onstage performance. Sure. As a gamer myself, I tell myself this when I allow myself to play, that it's promoting those fine motor skills and the dexterity.
That's what we tell ourselves, at least to justify it to our parents.
Absolutely. Totally.
The ability, a fine motor control. It's making me a better pianist.
That's right. It's improving my cognitive skills because, right. Man, I just died in that battle. So I get a do-over, and I'm going to re-strategize this boss battle. So that's going to also assist me in music performance, right?
Oh, Mindy, we are brother and sister from another mother, I got to say. I can already tell that you're one of us.
Well, here's where I kind of diverge a little bit. I'm not really sure. What do the extreme sports bring to sort of helping to cultivate that total performance package? Is it the adrenaline rush or the high energy?
Rush, but it's more risk.
Ah.
No, there's nothing more tightrope walking than a performance. Let me just speak to my recent performance with the Dubuque Symphony. The idea that a guy from out of town comes into a place within 2 days with 60 other people, create this high wire act, that they get one shot at doing, that there is no do-overs, no edits, and they do it in front of 1,000 people. Now, that kind of pressure would terrify most. It's the fear of public speaking, of course, taken to the ultimate degree.
Mm-hmm.
And you're playing a revered piece of work, of which has been recorded, hundreds of times, and every note is well known. And so there's this perfection that is there. And if you had, if you're of the type of personality to not be a risk taker, there's no way that you would be able to do that. And that's kind of one of the lessons that I have told to the young people that I play for and teach and do outreach for occasionally is that that's why music education is good for everyone, especially a young person, because all of us have to perform or take a risk, step up the plate, and take a swing at some point in their lives. And that is a skill that needs to be practiced as much as learning notes are, because whether or not you are applying to college, negotiating a salary for a job, asking someone out for a date, you're taking a leap of faith. And if you are able to practice that and be in control of that, I believe that can impact your life in positive ways that can't really be measured.
Well, you have an extremely visionary and totally accessible approach to reaching young people, I have to say, in watching again a concert that you performed where it was in front of grade schoolers. Now, there's no tougher audience than grade schoolers.
Oh, God. I joke that there's no adult audience that I fear. There's no music critic that I fear, because there's no one more critical and honest than fifth graders. If they're bored, they'll let you know. There's no polite applause when it comes to kids at that age.
Yeah, there's tumbleweeds rolling through the room and the sounds of crickets chirping. Yeah.
Oh, the crickets can be deafening.
But, on the other hand, the way that the fact that you've managed to find a way to keep grade schoolers entertained so superbly through that time where they're actually enjoying it. And here's what I really like, Alpin. When I started playing piano too, you mentioned at one point how we're sort of at the tail end of that very golden age of sort of formal performance style.
Yeah.
And I'd love how performers now are moving into a much less formal, much more audience interactive and audience friendly style of performance. And you talk about how that invests the audience so much more in who you are. Yeah, they're hearing a piece of music that for some, yeah, they'll be hearing it for the first time, but for others, they do know this piece note by note by note. So what's going to make your performance stand out?
Exactly. Well, I mean, I think live performers, that's the one thing we have that pre-recorded, pre-rendered entertainment through the internet cannot offer, is interactivity. The fact that our performances in front of you are in time, and like I said, there is no reset button, there's no rewind. And in a way, I tell the audience that this is a once-in-a-lifetime experience. You will never breathe quite the same. You'll never see it with quite the same audience, you know, having had the dinner that you had. And so that kind of individual experience is something that I believe the orchestra or classical music or any live performance really can offer, and which is, I think, is the types of experiences that you can share face to face, that you can talk about afterwards with the person who witnessed it with you, that unlike, I think, targeted entertainment, which is, you know, movies these days,
yes,
it's either for young men aged 18 to 42, it's for couples, it's for older people, it's for kids, you know, the fact that
this crosses all demographics. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's what I'm hoping this show can be. I have now played it, as I said before, for inner city elementary school kids. I've played it for professional theater goers in Atlanta and Phoenix and Wisconsin. So in diverse areas in the United States, diverse socioeconomic demographics. And everyone's been able to bring something away from it. And it's very gratifying to me that a story of Korean-American, second-generation, ex-skateboarding, video game-loving, pre-med student, Juilliard graduate concert pianist can resonate. I think that's it's really wonderful, and it's an amazing feeling.
Well, I especially, what really struck a chord, pardon the pun, with me, was when you were kind of talking about, you know, your early days of practicing, and your mother would let you know as soon as there was an imperfect note, and those were some of my earliest music experiences too, was that same kind of feeling of not performing up to someone else's expectations, or again, not having the performance be absolutely perfect. But you found a way to really keep the joyfulness in your approach when you come out on stage, and you talk a lot about how, you know, performance is key, preparation is key, posture is key, look like you know what you're doing. People will kind of follow. I think the thing that was my biggest takeaway from that was that ability to sort of improvise. One of the best pieces of advice my dad ever gave me was don't panic. And there's been so many times in my life where it's like you're doing the, you know, in your case, you were talking about playing a piece and suddenly you blank. You know this piece very well. But all of a sudden, where did that bar line go? Okay, I've lost the next 17 measures. So what do I do? Don't panic, but improvise. And I loved what you had to say about that with music performance.
Well, thank you. I used a lot of quotes by master musicians through the years, like Thelonious Monk. He said, there are no wrong notes. Some are just more right than others. There's a famous slacky guitarist named Victor Wooten who did this performance where he said, there are no wrong notes, only notes that last too long. And I thought those are really just wonderful takes, and there's been many variations on that adage through the years. But that idea that your performance is your own and you can own it, and that the realization that a lot of, especially classical musicians, because we are the only performers perhaps that compete against 10-year-olds and dead people, we go up there that we're trying to replicate this hallowed tradition of performance. And we forget that what makes our performance compelling is that it is us performing Beethoven and Chopin and Bach. And people, it is as much an expression of who we are as what the music is. And because I always argue, why would you hear a pianist play Rachmaninoff the Third Piano Concerto when you can just pick up an immortal recording by Vladimir Horowitz? You know, because it's my hope that if that artist has a vision of that piece and the performance of that, you know, piece brings something of themselves to that piece, that you can find something new even in the old. And that is the great challenge between interpretive and creative artists. For example, talking about improvisation, I've just started exploring that myself, and it's a very frightening journey, because as Yoda says, you have to unlearn what you have learned. And if you have 35 years of mastering, you know, putting all the little black dots in the exact right order at the right tempo, at the right volume, playing without that roadmap can be a very destabilizing prospect. But there's something so wonderful in it. You know, it allows me to put a little creativity, which is why I think my calling card these days is this Twinkle Twinkle Death Star.
Yes.
Theme and variation.
Love it.
Just for your, or just as a little secret, is the credits music for this theatrical show.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, going to that piece, that's where, I got a lot of this takeaway of the ability that you have to improvise. Is you're playing Mozart's Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, and you talk about how, you know, it's a virtuosic piece. It's not perhaps one of the most difficult piano pieces to play. Although when you watch your fingers flying on the keyboard, it looks it's pretty amazing. But, you know, it seems like a pretty simple, straightforward piece. You know, it's in a simple key. And you were talking about, you know, playing, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, I have no idea what comes up next. What else is in the key of C? And, you know, you didn't panic. Yes. You just started to improvise. And pretty soon, you know, you went to Star Wars. You went to the Death Star theme. You know, oh, I can play that. And then it was like, okay, now Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. I don't want to spoil any more for anybody, because this is an amazing and super fun progression that you do. But I love the fact that not only does that sort of illustrate clearly what you're talking about, but you manage to incorporate so many different musical genres across the board that I think it really illustrates to people how relevant and cool, honestly, classical music is, because it relates to all these other musical forms, and this is how it's done.
Thank you so much, Randy, for saying that. I really appreciate it. I'm attempting to do that. It's reminded me of a comment that I got in Dubuque the last time I was there. I was playing the Liszt Concerto, which is, Liszt was perhaps history's first rock star, and his music is, you know, virtuosic to, you know, a stunning degree. And I got a comment afterwards that I seemed more like a rock musician than I do a classical musician. And I really appreciate that. I've always said that because my musical background, I didn't really listen to classical music or go to classical music concerts until I was much older. My first real experience was after I entered Juilliard in New York City. I saw Mahler Fifth Symphony played by the Vienna Philharmonic in Carnegie Hall. You can only imagine how amazing that was. And I realized that this music that I had been playing, I fell in love with it late in life. The music I was listening to growing up is anybody living in the Midwest as a kid with those hair bands, like, Poison, Def Leppard, Guns N' Roses, and then, you know, moving to Southern California where I had hip-hop and then grunge rock like Pearl Jam and Stone Temple Pilots coming out of Seattle and Nirvana, and then moving on to electronic music. So it's those types of music that I hear in my head as I'm playing this great classical music, which obviously affects my approach, my tempo, my emotional backdrop. So I hope that it makes my performances unique. And fortunately, I seem to have fooled a lot of people into thinking that too.
No, you really give, again, it's a very high energy. It's fun to watch. And again, I like the fact that it brings together all demographics, all music types. Everybody can come together and have a lot of fun at your show when they see, again, your very joyful approach to the music. You're having a great time. And that fear that kind of gets in the way of most of us with respects to performance, if it's there, we don't see it in you at all. You really do project that confidence and just that sort of c'est la vie. This is what it is. Here, you know, here I am, and this is what I bring to the table.
Yeah, well, that may be more an acting technique than it is a musical technique, I will say. Let me just say that, you know, because this show, unlike my other performances, is perhaps more, I would say, 70% acting and speaking to 30% playing piano, as opposed to my usual concerts, which is 85% playing and maybe 15% of narratives and speaking. It was very gratifying to me. Like I said, this show had just performed it at Lincoln Center. And I had not been back to perform at Lincoln Center since I graduated from Juilliard 15 years ago. To go back as a theater actor rather than a classical pianist, per se, was just an amazing feeling. Because I felt if I had gone back and just played a piano recital there, I think I also would have been overcome with the normal terror of living up to the hallowed traditions of the great institutions around me. But since I was coming back doing something that I felt was individual to me, I was able to actually be less frightened about what people might think. Because who else is going to be able to tell me how to tell my story, right?
Right.
And so it's very liberating, actually, to approach a performance in that way. So I have to thank my collaborators at the Flying Carpet Theater, Adam Copeland, who co-wrote and directed the scripts with me, for recognizing that and encouraging me to strike out on that path.
Well, you are just an amazing person, I have to say. I have so many more questions I would love to ask you, but I don't dare trespass on your time. You've got a very busy itinerary ahead. I want to thank you, though, for just the takeaways that I got from hearing you speak and in the various forums that you were at of approaching life and dealing with things as they come, that you kind of have the TRs in life. There's something happens to you, so you have to make a transition because you have
right.
to deal with what has happened. Then you have to transform in a way because nothing's ever going to be the same again. And then
right.
hopefully Absolutely. You can transcend, and that's what you have been able to really tap into. And I find that personally inspiring.
Well, thank you so much, Mindy. I hope so. That transitioning and transforming and transcending, I think that truly happens, and this is on my mind right now as I watch my baby girl walk around our house.
Oh.
You know, becoming a parent, you do that all at once, and
yes.
and to a degree that is almost, unexplainable in any other way. And so being in that headspace right now and then reflecting on what, this story is as much about my parents as it is about myself, and investigating what their world must have been like, what their challenges were, how they approached raising us, in a different country. It's my hope that anybody in this, whether or not people are a musician or a student or an immigrant or an artist, the one thing that I hope we can come back to is to try to get into deeper understanding of who our parents might have been. And as they say, if you don't know your history, you don't know yourself. And I think, mm-hmm. I hope that the show at the very least will allow people to make a deeper connection to those that they love. And I think if that's true, then we're successful no matter what happens to the show.
And along the way, it's going to enhance everyone's appreciation of the beautiful music of Frédéric Chopin along the way.
I certainly hope so. I do. I certainly hope so.
Well, this has been a blast, Alpin. Like I said, I have 1,000 more things I would love to ask you. And I hope you've enjoyed it as well, folks listening, tuning in this afternoon. And you got to hear a little bit about Alpin, learn a little bit about him. I'm telling you, just talking to him, he's as amazing, if not more so, on stage. So this is a show you are not going to want to miss. Trust me on this. His performances are electric. They're inspiring. He is just super fun. Okay, so guess what? He's going to be performing in Dubuque on Wednesday, March 9th. So get your tickets for this concert. This will be one fantastic evening. Wednesday, March 9th, let me say that again, 7:30. The concert starts at the University of Dubuque's Heritage Center. Get your tickets, 563-585-SHOW.